Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So today's sutta, which we're going to be reading out, is number 65, the Badali Sutta. Number 65 of the Majjhima Nikaya. And as you know, these 152 sutras in the Majjhima Nikaya have many different themes to them. Some are very deep, some are not so deep. But every one of them has some sort of purpose to them. And the main purpose of this Badali Sutta is actually shows just how one's attitude, especially to one's precepts, is an important factor in developing deep meditation and eventual enlightenment. It tells the story of one monk who basically was a monk but didn't really care to train himself and didn't really listen to what the Buddha was saying. But eventually he saw the error of his ways and the Buddha gave him an admonition. And it's interesting to see how the Buddha admonishes basically a scallywag monk, as I call them, a monk who wasn't really behaving appropriately, and how he admonishes that monk, and how that monk understands that you do need to follow the instructions of your teacher, and you do need to be a good listener to the Dhamma. And if you do such things, it's a natural course that the deep meditations and enlightenment happen. So it also gives you an insight into what the monks were like in the time of the Buddha. And they don't change today. Lay people in the time of the Buddha, lay people today, and people just don't change. And that's one of the interesting parts about reading some of these stories in these ancient texts, because they're at least 2,300 years old, or 400, even 500 years old. 2,500 years old, and it gives a window into a different culture, a different time. And when I read these stories, you can actually relate to them. It was as if they were happening today, because the same defilements, the same attitudes, the same silly things which happened then, happen today. So here we go. The Badali Sutta number 65. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jeta's Grove and Natapindika's Park. There he addressed the monks thus. Monks, Venerable Sir, they replied, and the Blessed One said this, the standard opening. So another sutta which was given at the Jeta Grove in Sawati, the famous Jetavana, which many of you have visited on pilgrimage, and you may be able to visualize that beautiful park, and this was where this sutta began. Bhikkhus, I eat at a single session. By so doing, I am free from illness and affliction, and I enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Come, monks, eat at a single session. By so doing, you too will be free from illness and affliction, and you will enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding. So the Buddha was asking people just to eat the one meal of the day. And as the commentary in the back says, the eating one meal a day is not technically obligatory for monks. You can have a small breakfast in the morning. But what he was saying here was that the Buddha, during this particular time, wanted all the monks staying with him just to have that one meal. Not as a vinaya rule, but as just an encouragement. Because what happened next was, when this was said, the Venerable Badali told the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, I am not willing to eat at a single session, for if I were to do so, I might have worry and anxiety about it. Then, Badali, eat one part there where you are invited when you go for a meal and bring away another part to eat. By eating in that way, you will maintain yourself. And you can see the Buddha was actually still within the rules. The Vinaya was giving him a little way out of just if he can't eat enough in one sitting, you can take something back for later as long as it's eaten before midday. But what did Badali say? Venerable Sir, I am not willing to eat in that way either, for if I were to do so, I might also have worry and anxiety about it. So he was not following what the teacher was saying. Then when this training precept was being made known by the Blessed One, when the Bhikkhu Sangha was undertaking the training, the Venerable Badali publicly declared his unwillingness to undertake the training. You may notice there is a, if you have one of the older versions of the book, there is a different translation there. Because actually I pointed out to Bhikkhu Bodhi that what it really means is not the first translation he did was when Venerable Badali publicly declared in the Sangha of Bhikkhus. That actually is not quite true. The Venerable Badali publicly declared when this Bhikkhu Sangha was undertaking the training that he was unwilling to undertake it. And then the Venerable Badali did not present himself to the Blessed One for the whole of that 3-month period of the rains, as he did not fulfill the training in the teacher's dispensation. Now I'll pause there. It shows there from the last sentence that this was like a special training which the Buddha wanted his monks to do for the 3 months rains retreat. Just to do the 1 meal a day practice. And the Badali said, no, he doesn't want to do that. And the Buddha said, oh, okay, you can maybe just take something back afterwards. And Badali said, no, I won't do that either. So he wasn't actually following the instructions of his teacher. And because of that, or maybe as a symptom of that stubbornness, he never even went to see the Buddha for those whole 3 months. Now I'll pause there. Are there any comments or questions about that so far? Okay, so again, it shows that even in the time of the Buddha, sometimes the Buddha, the great teacher, would give some advice, and again, sometimes people would argue with him and not keep it. Now, on one occasion, a number of monks were engaged in making a robe for the Blessed One, thinking with this robe completed, at the end of the 3 months of the rains, the Blessed One will set out wandering. And again, for those of you who have been to our Katina ceremonies or the rains retreat, you know that the rains retreat was a period for 3 months when the monks would stay in one place, would do a lot of meditating or studying, and after the 3 months, that would be when they went left the monastery and be traveling from place to place. And for those of you who sometimes give me a hard time for traveling so much, you can see that at the end of the 3 months, the Blessed One will set out wandering. So I'm just following in the footsteps of the Buddha by wandering a lot these days. Then the Venerable Badali went to those bhikkhus and exchanged greetings with them. And when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side. When he had done so, those monks said to Badali, "Friend Badali, this robe is being made up for the Blessed One. With his robes completed at the end of the 3 months of the rains, the Blessed One will set out wandering. Please, friend Badali, give proper attention to your declaration. Do not let it become more difficult for you later." So they were warning him that the Buddha was about to leave in a short time. He only had few days to actually to say sorry to the Buddha. And they were saying if he didn't say sorry, then it would be a great obstacle for him in the future. His stubbornness would be to his detriment. So Badali replied, "Yes, friends," he replied. And he went to the Blessed One, and having paid homage to him, he sat down on one side and said, "Venerable Sir, a transgression overcame me, in that like a fool, confused and blundering, when a training precept was being made known by the Blessed One, I publicly declared in the Sangha of Bhikkhus my unwillingness to undertake the training. Venerable Sir, may the Blessed One forgive my transgression seen as such, for the sake of restraint in the future." So, you know, he's obviously, during those 3 months, with the advice of the fellow monks, his friends, he decides to ask forgiveness from the Buddha. And this is actually how the Buddha admonishes him. "Surely, Badali, a transgression overcame you, in like a fool, confused and blundering, when a training precept was being made known by me, you publicly declared in the Sangha of monks your unwillingness to undertake the training. Badali, this circumstance was not recognized by you. The Blessed One is living in Sarvati, and the Blessed One will know me thus. The monk named Badali is one who does not fulfill the training in the teacher's dispensation. This circumstance was not recognized by you. Also, this circumstance was not recognized by you. Many monks have taken up residence at Sarvati for the rains, and they too will know me thus. The monk named Badali is one who does not fulfill the training in the teacher's dispensation. This circumstance too was not recognized by you. Also, this circumstance was not recognized by you. Many bhikkhunis have taken up residence at Sarvati for the rains, and they too will know me thus. The monk named Badali is one who does not fulfill the training of the teacher's dispensation. This circumstance too was not recognized by you. Also, this was not recognized by you. Many men lay followers, many women lay followers are staying at Sarvati, and they too will know me thus. The monk named Badali is one who does not fulfill the training in the teacher's dispensation. This circumstance was not recognized by you. Also, this circumstance was not recognized by you. Many recluses and Brahmins of other sects have taken up residence at Sarvati for the rains, and they too will know me thus. The monk named Badali, an elder disciple of the recluse Gotama, is one who does not fulfill training in the teacher's dispensation. This circumstance was not recognized by you. In other words, that whatever a monk does, the word usually gets around. I tell my monks at Serpentine that I'm not quite sure how it happens, but if any monk misbehaves or does something, everybody knows about it. I don't know how you get to know about it, but the grapevine is very, very strong between the monks and all the lay people who come to Dhammaloka. So he's saying that, look, now when you did this, many people know that about you, so it gives rise to a feeling of shame. Now this is important here, I'll just pause on this point, because you may notice here that what the Buddha is employing is not punishing him or shouting at him or having a punishment, you know, like beating or anything. The whole purpose of the Buddha's talk here is to bring up a sense of shame that his actions would be known by others, and they're obviously inappropriate actions, and thereby using in Buddhism we call hiri otapa, and hiri is like a fear of shame, and otapa is actually the understanding of the karmic consequences of your wrong actions. And those two together, the Buddhists call that the guardians, you know, of morality. You know, we don't sort of employ like the stick or any other type of punishment, but just that internal, you know, what am I doing this for? And it's not going to be for my happiness, and it's also I feel ashamed that, you know, this is known by so many people. And that was actually very often how the Buddha would try and discipline his disciples, using shame. Any comments about that? Well, sometimes, as you know, some young people wear their shame like a badge of honor, which is one of the problems. But so it has to be ashamed with your peer group. And I think this is what the Buddha was employing here. His peer group, you know, was the monks and the nuns, the laymen and laywomen supporters, and even the members of the other sects, the other religious people at the time, because, you know, they too were almost like your peers. And I think that even though we are in an individualistic society, we do have our peers, our group of friends. And I think that that's usually a very powerful way of getting something done. And maybe your son or your daughter is misbehaving. And if it's your daughter, you know, get her boyfriend to exert pressure on her. So the peers have much more pressure on kids, on anybody, than someone who's outside of their peer group. That makes sense? So, again, for the second time, Badali accepts this and says, "Venerable Sir, a transgression overcame me in that, like a fool confused and blundering, when a training precept was being made known by the Blessed One, I publicly declared in the Sangha of monks my unwillingness to undertake the training. Venerable Sir, may the Blessed One forgive my transgression, seen as such for the sake of restraint in the future." The Buddha said, "Surely, Badali, a transgression overcame you in that, like a fool confused and blundering, when a training precept was being made by me, you publicly declared in the Sangha of monks your unwillingness to undertake the training." But notice he hasn't forgiven him yet, because the Buddha is still pushing forward to make sure the underlying reason, which is his stubbornness, his inability just to accept the Buddha as his teacher and not to act accordingly, was the reason why he did not surrender himself to that training rule. So the Buddha continues. What do you think, Badali? Suppose a monk here were one liberated in both ways, and I told him, come, monk, be a plank for me to walk across the mud. Would he walk across himself, or would he dispose his body otherwise, or would he say no? He said no. In other words, that's not a very good translation. What it really means, that would he just lay down and let me walk over him so I wouldn't get my feet dirty? And he said, yes, of course, if he was an arahat liberating both ways, that's what he would do. Now, not the Buddha would ever ask him to do that, because never once did I see the Buddha taking advantage of any disciples in the lifetime of the Buddha, but he said that's how much obedience and faith that they would have. If the teacher asked them, there's a muddy pool there, could you just put your body on there so I don't get my feet muddy, then they would do it for him. And obviously he's making the point there that Badali, he wasn't asked to lay down in the mud so the Buddha could walk over him, which is asked to keep a precept, which was a precept of restraint, and he wouldn't even do that much. But also in this passage here, we got the different types of what we call Ariyas, the noble ones, starting with one liberated both ways. And one liberated both ways, who knows what that is? One liberated both ways. Now, don't look at the back, that's cheating. No. Yes. That's what it actually, not quite. You're almost there. But the two ways are supposed to be liberated by wisdom, liberated by mind. But that's just the name of it. What it actually really means, and this is very true, very clearly stated in the Anguttara Nikaya. The next one is liberated by wisdom. Liberated by wisdom, these are the two types of arahats, fully enlightened ones. Liberated by wisdom is one who has gone to at least the fourth jhana, but has not gone through the arupa jhanas. One liberated by both ways is one who's also developed the arupa jhanas, as well as the rupa ones. That is a difference. And that's very, very clearly stated in the Anguttara Nikaya. Now, I mention that because sometimes people are under the misapprehension that liberated by wisdom means they haven't got jhanas, and they just done what people say these days is pure vipassana, and liberated both ways means you've had a jhana. However, that is very much unsubstantiated by the texts. The two ways of arahats, all the arahats have the jhanas. That's very, very clear. The liberated both ways means they have the arupa jhanas as well. In particular, I would actually say that they've gone so far as to have the experience of cessation, Nirodha Samapatti, when everything has stopped, including the mind and consciousness. Does that make sense there? Have you know enough about the Dhamma and meditation to know those, the important point there? Because sometimes we argue about these things in amongst monks. But unfortunately, the Anguttara Nikaya has not been well translated yet. The last translation was done a long time ago. But Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi and others are working on that. And when that's out, at the very end, you will actually see very clearly. I think it's in the Anguttara 8s. Oh, they'll say the Anguttara 9s, I think. No. I think it might be the 8s. Were the two types of arahats. The one liberated both ways, and then the one liberated through wisdom. What it actually really means, just to elaborate on that, if you remember that simile which I've given many times here of the thousand-petal lotus, and you've got to open up that lotus, enough layers of petals to be able to see what's in the middle of that lotus, the emptiness, the nothingness there. Then if you go close enough, and I say that at least into the jhanas, then the innermost petals are so thin that you can actually see through them without needing to open them. So at least if you get a first jhana, then you've got a chance of seeing right into the middle and seeing the emptiness there, enough to be enlightened, fully enlightened. However, that if you open up every petal to go right to the very center, then that's the liberated through mind and wisdom. If you've only liberated for so much, you know, you can actually only liberate it through wisdom, because you can actually see through them. You can perceive through, if you like, inference, just the emptiness at the end. Satipatthana stands like anywhere else. The Satipatthana is not vipassana, which is made very, very clear by sayings such as the Buddha in the Anapanasati Sutta. Anyone who fulfills the 16 steps of Anapanasati thereby also fulfills the four Satipatthanas. So Satipatthana is Anapanasati. And you know, the 12th set of Anapanasati, if you remember from my retreat talks, which you've heard, the 12th step of Anapanasati, Vimocha Yang Chitang, freeing of the mind, that is referring to jhanas. So you can't fulfill Anapanasati, the 16th steps, because the 12th step is jhana. So the only way you can fulfill the four Satipatthanas is also by experiencing jhana. So there is no shortcut. You've got to follow the Eightfold Path, all eight petas. Now, after you've got the liberating both ways, on paragraph 11, the Buddha actually goes down and says the same thing about the other types of noble ones, Aryas. What do you think, Badali? Suppose a monk who were one liberated by wisdom, a body witness, one attained to view, one liberated by faith, a Dharma follower, faith follower. And I told him, come, monk, be a plank for me to walk across the mud. Would he walk across himself, or would he dispose his body otherwise, or would he say no? No, he wouldn't just walk across himself and let me get muddy. He wouldn't dispose his body otherwise. He wouldn't say no. He would actually lay down for me. Now, for those types of Aryas, now we go for the other types of Aryas. We've got the two Arahats, liberated both ways and liberated by wisdom. A body witness, a Kayasaki, is someone. It can be a stream winner. One's attained the path of stream winning. It can be a once returner or an anagami, and each one of these has to have had an experience of a jhana. The Kayasaki. So they've got the four jhanas, those Kayasakis. One attained to view, this is like a stream winner, called a Dittipata stream winner. And this is another way of calling a stream winner, because a stream winner has seen the view of non-self. They've got perfect view. That's why sometimes they're called attained to view. And it's a very good point there, because sometimes people say that, oh, in Buddhism the whole goal is actually having no view whatsoever, or no, having a sort of a woolly view which cannot fit into any circumstances. But every person has to have one view or another. Even a view you should have no view is a view in itself, if you understand my meaning. So each one of us has a sort of perceptual framework, which we call our view system. And the Buddha said there is a right view and there's a wrong view. There's a correct way of seeing and an erroneous way of seeing. And we're not actually saying that it's correct according to ultimate truth, but it's correct in the sense of it leads to enlightenment. So it's right view in the context of that particular view will lead to enlightenment, like the right road to get to serpentine, or the wrong road to get to serpentine. So it's not like, you know, there's right and wrong in some ultimate categories, but it's right in the context, if you go that road, it will get to the goal. So this is what I mean by attain to the right view, that you know what enlightenment is, you know how to get there. You've got a question. Where do his jhana was probably well before. Remember, sometimes those gods and something would have done some jhanas beforehand, and even like previous lives. Remember, devas are very, very strong beings. And there's another point there with, this is the whole discussion about whether you need jhanas to become a stream winner or not. Sometimes when they say he became a stream winner, The Pali idioms are such that if you are on the path to being a stream winner, they make hardly any distinction at all between being a stream winner. So sometimes people on the path, and people actually achieve that goal, are lumped in one category. So again, we don't really know whether he was actually really was a stream winner or one on the path to being a stream winner. And that's the same with even other categories, like especially like Visakha was supposed to be a stream winner. But some of the things which she did afterwards and some of her attitudes, you think, wow, could she have been a stream winner? Or was she on the path to being a stream winner? Or someone even more importantly, like Sarakani, who was an alcoholic and who was declared to be a stream winner. But was he actually on the path of being a stream winner, or was he actually a stream winner? And this is the difficult way of deciding in Pali. Because in the Pali language, if something is certain to happen, then it has happened. Very similar if in those crime novels, if the mafia man has caught you cheating them, and they say, you know, Ainsley, you cheated me out of my goods, you're dead. And you say, I'm not dead, I'm still alive, my heart's still beating. But when they say you're dead, it means actually you will be dead for certain. Now that's an idiom which we do have in English. If something's absolutely certain to happen, you know, like you're dead man walking. And they say it's very similar to in Pali. If the attainment of stream winning is absolutely certain, then you're stream winner. Even though technically you're not. And that idiom is there in a couple of places in Pali, which makes it very difficult when the Buddha says you're a stream winner. It's actually to know whether he meant you are already or you're definitely going to be. Anyway, that's the one attained to view, one liberated by faith, or a Dharma for liberated by faith. Okay, now that's somebody who is a stream winner. Again, but who his main path of being a stream winner is because of their faith in the teachings. So to understand fully what these mean, you have to go to the Buddha's explanation of the five spiritual powers, the indriya. And those indriya are faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. And that if one is mostly powered by the faith, and the faith is the strongest part, which leads you stream winning, then you're liberated by that faith. If your wisdom is the most powerful, then basically you'll eventually become one attained to view. The Dharma follower and the faith follower, again, those two types of, the stronger of those two indriyas, spiritual faculties, whether it's a faith faculty is stronger than your wisdom, or the wisdom faculty is stronger than your faith. Whether you're somebody who is just, you can see sometimes people who are just so faithful that whatever the teacher says, they will accept it immediately, and they won't even question it. And that sort of faith, if you put your faith in a good teacher, then it's very, very powerful. But some people will not actually do anything on faith. They will think about it, they will investigate it, and only when it's reasonable and it's according to their experience, then they will follow it. They're a person who's like a Dhamma follower. It's the wisdom aspect of those two things, is the most powerful. So those five indriyas, the first and the fifth, are being focused on here. The five indriyas, faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. If the faith one is what really motivates you more than anything, then you are a faith follower. If the wisdom one is what motivates you, that's a Dhamma follower. And those are the two types of people on the path of being a stream winner. It's a very interesting observation by the Buddha, because to actually achieve the insight which makes you a stream winner, like sometimes people, you know, just by belief means you've got so much faith, you will follow that Eightfold Path, you know, and even if it doesn't make much sense to you, you don't know where it's going, you'll follow that, you'll do all of the practices simply because that's what your teacher advises. And because of that, you have the full effort there and you'll eventually get that goal. Other people, they need to think about it before they will actually do it. They'll have to investigate it, and then they become like the Dhamma followers. And I think in my book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, I made the point of those two, the Dhamma followers, the ones who go by the investigation and wisdom, are far more common than the faith followers. And a lot of time it's because it's a far more certain path. Because those who have faith can have faith in anything. There are many different types of teachings and teachers. You don't know actually who to believe until you find it out for yourself. So the faith followers are the more dangerous type. Because I think you all know that there's been some very weird sects have gone around over the years. And sometimes it's amazing just what people put faith into. And what people would believe. So belief is very, very dangerous. But it's also powerful. And the Buddha was recognizing if you have faith and like the Buddha, it's powerful enough to move you towards stream winning. But the other one is that using your wisdom faculty. And that's the one which we always encourage much more than faith. But and nevertheless, if the faith is the thing which really motivates you to become then you're on the path to being a stream winner, as long as you're having faith in the right way. Or if it's through wisdom, it's motivating you to become a Dhamma follower. If there's one, what, sorry? Certainly, wisdom, yeah. It will, yes. But nevertheless, that characteristic of being very, very faithful will still be there afterwards. So even though you've experienced this of the Dhamma, whatever else the Buddha says, you know, you'd also just take it on board straight away without any questioning. So that faith characteristic will be with you for a long time, even past stream winning, and even past arahat. If you're one who's like a wisdom follower, then that characteristic will dominate you. So you can see that someone like Sariputta would be a wisdom follower, and even after his enlightenment would become a very, very wise person, able to investigate and explain things much better than any faith follower. But that is a very, very common group of the Aryas, the noble ones, the two types of arahats. And then next is no distinction being made between the Anagami, Satagami, Sakadagamis and stream winners. They're called the body witness, attained to view, or liberated by faith. There's three types. And then the two on the path to being a stream winner, the Dharma follower and the faith follower. And those are the Aryas, the noble ones. And is there any more questions on that before we go on? Correct, yes. So the core characteristic continues on. That's why the characteristics can be very, very similar from birth to birth. The similar which I've given before to explain rebirth, like the two mangoes. You eat a mango today, you plant the seed. A few years later, you get another mango tree. When it bears its first fruit, you eat the next mango. And of course, nothing goes across. The DNA is completely different. The chemicals completely different. But one is a mango, the other is a mango. You can see the connection, the cause and effect process between the old mango you ate and the new mango from the new tree. But the new mango will have some of the characteristics of the old mango. If the old mango was sour, then the new mango will be sour. But it won't be quite the same. The characteristics will change slightly. And if the old mango was like really big, the new mango was likely to be large. So you can actually see just because of the cause and effect relationship, which happens every moment, that the characteristics actually have a path to be preserved. They can change slightly, but they're likely to be very similar from life to life. That's right, yes. But he was actually a faith follower. Because Angulimala, the reason why he killed all of those people was because his former teacher told him to. And, you know, this is why putting faith in people faith in your teacher, you know, can be very dangerous. You know, my teacher told me to do this. And sometimes people will do that. So I've got to be very, very careful. Sometimes I've come across that. Sometimes that, you know, people have got too much faith in me and I'm saying, can you turn right at the lights? And I have to say, when they are green. Okay. So now we have. What do you think, Badali? Were you on that occasion when he said he wouldn't keep that rule? Were you on that occasion one liberated in both ways, or one liberated by wisdom, or a body witness, or one attained to view, or one liberated by faith, or a Dhamma follower, or a faith follower? No, Venerable Sir. Badali, on that occasion were you not an empty, hollow wrongdoer? Yes, Venerable Sir. Venerable Sir, a transgression overcame me, like a fool, confused and blundering. When our training precept was being made known by the Blessed One, I publicly declared in the Sangha of monks my unwillingness to undertake the training. Venerable Sir, may the Blessed One forgive my transgressions, seen as such for the sake of restraint in the future. So surely, Badali, a transgression overcame you, in that like a fool, confused and blundering, when a training precept was being made known by you, you publicly declared in the Sangha of monks your unwillingness to undertake the training. But since you see your transgression as such, and make amends in accordance with the Dhamma, we forgive you. For it is growth in the Noble One's discipline, when one sees one's transgression as such, and makes amends in accordance with the Dhamma by undertaking restraint in the future. So now the Buddha's actually forgiven him. So the matter's finished there. So this is actually how the Buddha would admonish transgressors. He'd focus on what was the main point of his transgression. And the rule in itself was not the point. It was just his unwillingness to actually to follow the teacher and actually to take his advice. He was just stubbornness, arrogance. And so that the Buddha had to make the point, make it very clear to him that what the fault was. And then when he asked forgiveness, you might notice three times the Buddha said, yes, okay, we forgive you, because when you acknowledge your fault, you see it, you see the real fault, not the symptoms, but the cause of it. And then you make amends. Then that is growth in the Noble One's discipline. When one sees one's transgression as such and makes amends in accordance with the Dhamma. How? By undertaking restraint in the future. So that's actually what, there's no punishment there. There's acknowledgement and then undertaking restraint in the future, not doing it again. And the matter's finished. But the Buddha uses the occasion to also actually teaches him something about why it is a mistake. It's not just for the sake of you not having faith in the teacher and causing him trouble, but it's actually causing yourself trouble, as now we will see. And this is also an important part of this sutta. Because it shows just, you know, the training and the obedience is important to actually one's success in meditation and one's attainment of insight. Here, Badali, some monk does not fulfill the training in the teacher's dispensation. He considers thus, suppose I were to resort to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw. Perhaps I might realize a superhuman state, a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of noble ones. This is a standard description of someone who's aspiring for the enlightenment states or the jhanas. You're going to the standard description of quiet, secluded places. And he does resort to some such secluded resting place. While he lives thus, withdrawn, the teacher censures him. Wise companions in the holy life who have made investigations censure him. God censures him, and he censures himself. Being censured in this way by the teacher, by wise companions in the holy life, by God and by himself, he realizes no superhuman state, no distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Why is that? That is how it is with one who does not fulfill the training in the teacher's dispensation. But here, Badali, some monk does fulfill the training in the teacher's dispensation. He considers thus, suppose I were to resort to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside, cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw, all secluded places. Perhaps I might realize a superhuman state, a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, which means either the jhanas or the states of enlightenment. And he resorts to some such secluded resting place. While he lives thus withdrawn, the teacher doesn't censure him, wise companions in the holy life who have made an investigation do not censure him, gods do not censure him, and he does not censure himself. Being uncensured in this way by the teacher, wise companions in the holy life, gods, and by himself, he does realize a superhuman state, a distinction of knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. And later it says, because that's what happens. I will pause there by saying that you can see that the teacher's censure, when it says his friends, it's interesting here, I'll point out to you, or ask for you to notice, that his companions in the holy life censure him only after they've made an investigation. So you don't go around censuring people just because someone else does. Even if the Buddha censures him, you investigate yourself, so you don't just believe in gossip. But they find out the other monks, your fellows in the holy life, they investigate what's going on, and when they discover yes, then they do censure him. And even the devas censure him. But most importantly of all, you censure yourself. Sorry? Guilt, yes. What's in the five hindrances we call kukkha, sense of remorse. Remember, that's the fourth hindrance, udacha kukkha. And kukkha means that remorse. Udacha means restlessness. And so he says you don't get anywhere that way. But he says when you do follow the training, then you're not censured by anybody. Most of all, not by yourself. So without that remorse, he said that you can go to these secluded places and you do get something. So it's not just going to a secluded place. It's what you go to that secluded place with. And if you haven't fulfilled, you know, the basic training, then you can go to those quiet places. And you can really meditate for days and days and days in the most perfect situation, but don't get anywhere. Let's continue now, but where do you get? He does get a distinction of knowledge and vision worthy of noble ones. Quiet, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, meaning the five hindrances, he enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by the movement onto the mind and staying with the mind, or staying with the pitisukha, which is accompanied, with rapture and pleasure born of such seclusion from the five senses. Why is that? That is how it is with one who fulfills a training in the teacher's dispensation. Now, I love this particular statement here because it says if you follow the training and then you go to a secluded place, they say this is what you can expect, the first jhana. Why is that? That is how it is with one who fulfills the training and the teacher's dispensation. So if you haven't got the first jhana yet, maybe you're not fulfilling the training. With the stilling of applied and sustained thought, or not thought, this again, as you know, this is a terrible translation. This is nothing to do with thinking. Thinking disappears way before you get close to these jhanas. This is the movement of the mind onto the object and the holding onto the object. With the fading away as well as... Okay, with the stilling of the movement onto the object and holding onto the object, you enter upon and abide in the second jhana. With the fading as well of rapture, you enter upon the third jhana. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, you enter upon and abide in the fourth jhana. Now in the Pali, these take a whole paragraph by themselves. This is just abbreviated. So in each one of these jhanas, why is that? Why do you attain each one of those jhanas? Because that is how it is with one who fulfills the training and the teacher's dispensation. When the concentrated mind is thus purified and bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, and again that's a word which I'll pause on there, Because when the mind has achieved a jhana, you're out afterwards. And it is very malleable. You can ask it anything and it will do it. Wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, you can direct it to the knowledge of recollection of past lives. And as I've taught here, that after you've attained a deep meditation, you can just ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? And if your mind has got into a jhana, or sometimes apparently very close, afterwards your mind is malleable. You ask it that question, it will go and get a past life for you. That's what we mean by malleable, wieldy, steady, and imperturbable. And thus, with the aspects and particulars, you recollect your manifold past lives. Why is that? That is how it is with the one who fulfills the training of the teacher's dispensation. When your concentrated mind is thus purified and bright, attained to imperturbability, you direct it to knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. That's according to karma. Thus, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the humans, you understand how beings pass on according to their karma. Why is that? Because that is how it is with one who fulfills the training of the teacher's dispensation. When your concentrated mind is thus purified and bright, attained to imperturbability, you direct it to the knowledge of the destruction of the taints, the asavas, the outflowings of the mind. And you understand as it actually is. This is suffering. This is the cause of suffering. This is the end of suffering. This is the way to the end of suffering. These are the outflowings, the cause of the outflowings of the mind. The end of the outflowings, the way to the outflowings of the mind. And that means that you are an arahant, fully enlightened. When you know and see thus, your mind is liberated from the asava of sensual desire. So the thing which sends you out into the world looking for pleasure in the five senses is finished. And from the asava of being, wanting to exist, which sends you out. Because one of the ways you express your existence is going out to do things to show you're there. So the outflowing which is caused by your ignorance or delusion that there is something in here, an existing being, is gone. And lastly, the answer which comes from just not, I don't like the word ignorance, prefer delusion. Finished. So those outflowings are stopped. And from that you understand that it is liberated, there comes a knowledge, it is liberated. So when the mind is liberated from these things, there comes a knowledge, it is liberated. And you understand, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. So, that's the end of being for you. As it says in the Sanghita, that Nibbana Bhava Nirodho. Nibbana is the end, the cessation of being. That is how it is with one who fulfills the training in the teacher's dispensation. So Buddha is giving a very powerful teaching there. That's saying that, you know, if you follow the instructions, if you follow the training, these are the things which you can expect to happen. And sometimes people often ask me, you know, do you have to be like intelligent, you know, to be enlightened? A man? Can a woman become enlightened? Can a homosexual become enlightened? You know, what's the requirements there? What's the entry requirements to join the Arya Club? You can see here all it is. It doesn't matter, man, woman, Caucasian, Asian, African, whatever. It doesn't matter if your sexual preferences, it just means, are you fulfilling the training or not? Basically, are you following the instructions? So if you do follow the instructions, this is what can be expected. 1, 2, 3, 4, jhanas, states of enlightenment. That's a powerful teaching there. So it's not that, you know, I'm unable to do this, or some people are unable to. It's only people who follow the instructions are able. If you don't follow the instructions, that's what disables you. So can you become enlightened in this life? Of course, as long as you follow the instructions. So that's a powerful teaching there. Now Badali sort of goes on another tack. Thereupon the Venerable Badali asks, Venerable Sir, what is the cause, what is the reason while they take action against some monks repeatedly, the admonishing him should not be there. While they repeatedly take action against some monks, what is the cause, what is the reason why they don't take any action against some monks? In other words, why me? Now, other people are doing worse than I am. You know, the old sort of argument which people have. And the Buddha actually faces that argument very squarely. I mean, why? And there's always someone on your back, and they let other people get away with murder. Here, Badali, some monk is a constant offender with many offences. When he is corrected by the monks, he prevaricates, leads the talk aside, shows disturbance, hate and bitterness. He does not proceed rightly. He does not comply. He does not clear himself. He does not say, let me so act that the Sangha, and act that the Sangha will be satisfied. In other words, he doesn't listen. Bhikkhus taking account of this matter think, it would be good if the Venerable Ones examine this monk in such a way that this matter, not litigation, that's just the best word which Bhikkhu Bodhi could find. It's not like a legal matter, but this matter against him is not settled too quickly. And the monks examine that bhikkhu in such a way that the matter against him is not settled too quickly, because it's not getting anywhere. He just gets angry, just prevaricates. So just basically they just have to let the matter sort of drop for a while. This is not an extra punishment. It's to see if the fellow changes his attitude so that later on they can act properly. But here, some other monk is a constant offender with many offences. When he is corrected by the monks, he does not prevaricate, lead the talk aside, or show disturbance, hate and bitterness. He proceeds rightly, he complies, he clears himself, and he says, let me so act that the Sangha will be satisfied. Bhikkhus, taking account of this matter, think it would be good if the Venerable Ones examine the monk in such a way that this thing is against him is settled quickly. And the monks examine that monk in such a way that the matter is against him is settled very quickly. So he's an easy monk to deal with. So let's deal with him first of all. This other one, if he's going to be like that, just let him stew for a while. So sometimes they say that we act, what the Buddha was saying, we can act against you because we think that it's, you're going to actually change, it's worth our while. But some other people, they're just hopeless cases, and so we're not going to even bother. And this is a monk who's a constant offender. And here's some monks as a chance offender. And they do the same distinctions there. That if he's going to show hatred and prevaricate and not really try to help himself, it's a waste of time. But if he wants to be trained and he does listen, then they act against him quickly. So a chance offender without many offences, and a chance offender without many offences, number 26. When he is corrected by the monks, he does not prevaricate. And so the monks examine that bhikkhu in such a way that the matter against him is settled quickly. Paragraph 27. Here some monks progress by a measure of faith and love. In this case, the monks consider thus. Friends, this monk progresses by a measure of faith and love. Let him not lose that measure of faith and love, as he may if we take action against him by repeatedly admonishing him. Suppose a man had only one eye, then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, would guard his eye, thinking, let him not lose his one eye. So too, some monks progress by a measure of faith and love, and thinking, let him not lose that measure of faith and love, as he may if we take action against him by repeatedly admonishing him, they just leave him alone. So you know that sometimes there's some people, they're just starting to get some sort of interest in faith and love. And you realize by admonishing them, by telling them off, they would actually lose, that sort of friendliness, which is like a young sapling. You just have to treat it very, very tenderly and carefully. If you go at them too hard, they'll just be destroyed and they just want to leave. They won't want to listen anymore. So they said that some people, you don't admonish them because they're not strong enough to accept that admonishment. Their faith or their love, their friendliness towards the other monks is only starting. And they haven't got enough wisdom or commitment to really understand and accept the admonishment. So that's another reason why we don't admonish people. So he said, this is the cause. This is the reason why they take action against some monk here by repeatedly admonishing them. This is the cause, this is the reason why they do not take such action against some monks here by repeatedly admonishing them. And that's the same in life when you're admonishing someone. Now you have to think, now are they going to be listening? Is it really worthwhile? And if they're going to be give you anger back, you just leave it alone. And also just see that, you know, are they going to be open to such admonishment? Or, you know, is their commitment to the family or commitment to the company that strong yet that they can actually stand that admonishment? Or is it they're going to say, right, that's it, I'm leaving? So that's one of the reasons why the Buddha said we don't just admonish people evenly. We actually look at their characters and their situation first, and then we act accordingly. Is that clear? Now this is where we come next to a very, very famous teaching of the Buddha. When the Badali asked, Venerable Sir, what is the cause, what is the reason why there were previously fewer training rules and more monks became established in the final knowledge of Arahat? What is the cause, what is the reason why there are now more training rules and fewer monks become established as Arahats? That is how it is, Badali. When beings are deteriorating, the true Dharma is disappearing. When there are more training rules and fewer monks become established in final knowledge. The teacher does not, basically said, monks are deteriorating, so you need actually more rules to keep them in check. So, but he also says, the teacher does not make known the training rule for disciples until certain things are the basis for these taints become manifest in the Sangha. But when certain things that are basis for taints become manifest here in the Sangha, then the teacher makes known the training rules for disciples in order to ward off those things that are the basis for taints. And basically, what comes clear later, one of the causes are the monks or the Sangha becomes more popular. With popularity, they get sort of more fame and get proud. They get too many things, too many possessions. And that is a corruption for the monks. So therefore, as the monastics in the time of the Buddha became more popular, more many, that life became more comfortable, you do needed more rules. When it's very, very simple, when you haven't got very much, you don't need many rules. But as the monks or the Sangha became more wealthy, more respected, more famous, then they needed more rules. That is how it is, Badali. When beings are deteriorating, the teacher does not make known the training rule for disciples until certain things that are basis for taints become manifest in the Sangha. But when certain things that are basis for taints become manifest here in the Sangha, then the teacher makes known the training rules for disciples in order to ward off those things that are the basis for taints. Those things that are the basis for taints do not become manifest here in the Sangha until the Sangha has reached greatness. But when the Sangha has reached greatness, then those things that are the basis of taints become manifest here in the Sangha. And then the Buddha makes known the training rules for disciples in order to ward off those things that are the basis for taints. Those things that are the basis for taints do not become manifest here in the Sangha until the Sangha has reached the acme of worldly gain, the acme of fame, of great learning and long-standing renown. But when the Sangha has reached long-standing renown, then these things that are the basis for taints become manifest here in the Sangha, and the teacher makes known the training rule for disciples in order to ward off those things that are the basis for taints. So the problem is, the Buddha actually warned monks again and again, there's the three words, labha, sakkara, saloka, means gains, honor, and fame. He said, be really careful of these things, because these things were corrupt, sort of the Sangha. They corrupt anyone. Which means as long as we have our rules, that gains cannot be personal. Whatever stuff gets given to me, I have to share it with everybody else. I can't keep anything for myself. And I don't wear the best robes or live in the best hut. I try and live in the simplest hut. And honour and fame, you've got to be very, very careful that you don't. They're not honouring you. They're just honouring the Dhamma, honouring the Buddha. And any fame, it's not oneself is famous. It becomes just the... You know, you put it Ajahn Chah, because he's my teacher, that's why you're popular. So in other words, you try and get off the ego, get off the pride, get off the arrogance, because those are the causes for some of the problems in a Sangha, and the Buddha put all these rules down to make sure that the monks would be protected from the gains, honour and fame when a monastery, a monk or the Sangha became learned, well-known and famous. not just my monks, I rely on you as well to keep me in line. But especially your monks, because they're the ones who are closest to you. Okay, so there were a few of you, Badali. Now he goes on to another simile. There were a few of you, Badali, when I taught the Dhamma through the simile of the young thoroughbred colt. Do you remember that, Badali? No, Venerable Sir. To what reason do you attribute that? Venerable Sir, I have long been one who did not fulfill the training of the teacher's dispensation. They can understand what he means by the training there. That when he said he didn't want to just eat one meal a day, that was just a symptom of his basic stubbornness. He's realizing a long time he just hasn't listened when the Buddha's been teaching. That is not the only cause or the only reason, but rather by encompassing your mind with my mind, reading your mind, I have long known you thus. When I am teaching the Dhamma, this misguided man does not heed it, does not give it attention, does not engage it with all his mind. He does not hear the Dhamma with eager ears. So in other words, the Buddha said, yeah, I sussed you out years ago. Still, Badali, I will teach you the Dhamma through the simile of the young thoroughbred colt. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Badali replied, and the Blessed One said this. And obviously this time Badali was really listening. Badali, suppose a clever horse trainer obtains a fine thoroughbred colt. He first makes him get used to wearing the bit. While the colt is being made to get used to wearing the bit, because he is doing something that he has never done before, he displays some contortion, writhing and vacillation. But through constant repetition and gradual practice, he becomes peaceful in that action. When the colt has become peaceful in that action, the horse trainer further makes him get used to wearing the harness. While the colt is being made to get used to wearing the harness, because he is doing something that he has never done before, he displays some contortion, writhing, and vacillation. But through constant repetition and gradual practice, you become peaceful in that action. When the colt has become peaceful in that action, the horse trainer further makes him act in keeping in step, in running in a circle, in prancing, in galloping, in charging, and in the kingly qualities, in the kingly heritage, in the highest speed, in the highest fleetness, in the highest gentleness. While the colt is being made to get used to doing these things, because he is doing something that he has never done before, he displays some contortion, writhing, and vacillation. But through constant repetition and gradual practice, he becomes peaceful in those actions. When the colt has become peaceful in those actions, the horse trainer further rewards him with a rubbing down and a grooming. When a fine thoroughbred colt possesses these 10 factors, he is worthy of the king in the king's service and considers one of the treasures of a king. So you can obviously see the meaning here, that when you're training, there will always be some writhing contortions and vacillation. He said, that's to be expected. But you've got to accept that, and eventually you become settled in those actions. And it's interesting here, the word for actually peaceful or settled in those actions is parinibbayi. The whole thing is finished and settled. The work is done, gone. So it's an interesting, deeper meaning to understand the word parinibbana. It's completely done, finished. Doesn't need to worry about that one anymore. So too, sorry? Go on. What I'm alluding to there is parinibbana, so the goal of Buddhism, the final nibbana, understanding what that means. Because, again, many people philosophize and they speculate, what is the meaning of nirvana? But remember, these are metaphysical words which have a connection with their use in ordinary language. And I've already pointed out many times before, when a lamp went out, it nirvana'd. And every villager would understand that. So when the Buddha mentioned the word nirvana, people know what that word meant. They would not need to be philosophers. And every now and again, the word is used again. And here you can see the word. I mean, when the training of that colt is finished, and so is writhing, is vacillation, the trouble is finished.
it's nibbana again.
I can see what you mean there. That's valid according to modern psychology, but I don't think that's what the Buddha was meaning there. It just meant sort of that vacillation itself, not where it was coming from, had nibbana, had finished. So too, Bodhi, when a monk possesses 10 qualities, then they are worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, and unsurpassed field of merit for the world. Do you know what that is in Pali? Ahunayo, Pahunayo, Dakinayo, Anjali Karanayo, Anutarang Sam Punyaketang Lokasati. Well, you always chant in the qualities of the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. This is for the Sangha. So this is actually standard, which people chant many times, probably every day. You know, would you say Supatipano, Bhagavato, Sawaka Sangha, if you've done any of the evening chanting? And it goes to Ahunayo, Pahunayo, Dakinayo, Anjali Karanayo, Anuttarang Punyaketang Lokasat. That means worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, an unsurpassed field of merit for the world. So what monks are actually worthy of gifts? Worthy of hospitality, worthy of reverential salutation, an unsurpassed field of merit for the world. What are the 10? Here in Bodhi, a monk possesses the right view of one beyond training. The right intention of one beyond training, the right speech of one beyond training, the right action of one beyond training, the right livelihood of one beyond training, the right effort of one beyond training, the right mindfulness of one beyond training, the right concentration of one beyond training, the right knowledge of one beyond training, and the right deliverance of one beyond training, an arahat. I'll point out there that once you're enlightened, it's not that you abandon that Eightfold Path. You have the Eightfold Path as one beyond training. So you can see there, this isn't yet talking about the Arahat. You have the Eightfold Path. And also, you have the right knowledge, basically the knowledge of liberation and the right deliverance of one beyond training. When a monk possesses these 10 qualities, they are worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, an unsurpassed field of merit for the world. So what if you're just like a non-returner? Should you give any gifts to a non-returner? Should you give them dana, or just to a stream winner, or just to any old monk? The Buddha actually described it, said, if you're an arahat, you're an owner of those gifts. If you are a stream winner, once returned on anagami, you are like an inheritor of those gifts. You know, it's as if the Buddha got those gifts for you, you've inherited them. It's your inheritance from your father. And he said, if you are not even a stream winner, said, you know, you're a debtor. So you're getting those gifts, but you know, you're in debt. So you've got to make sure you become a stream winner to pay off your debts pretty quickly. That's how he said it to the monks. So it's very interesting how he said, if you're not an Arya yet and you're receiving the food of the faithful, you know, you're in debt. So if you know you do that all your life, you know, it's quite a big debt you're building up. But you know, if you're an Arya, then you know you don't own it, but at least that you know you deserve it because you're a inheritor. If you're an arahat, you're an owner of those gifts. You truly are worthy of them. So it just said, just like you can train a horse, in the same way you can train a person to eventually become an arahat. When you start the training, the Buddha said, it's going to be difficult. It'll be some vacillation. I don't like doing this. You know, I don't want to sort of sit meditation. I'd rather watch the TV or surf the net. And I don't want to keep these rules, these 5 precepts or 8 precepts or 10 precepts or 227 precepts. I don't want to do these rules. Of course, he said, there will be some sort of unpleasantness there. But just like a horse gets trained, it gets used to that, gets through that unpleasantness. And by getting through that unpleasantness, then you have these 10 wonderful qualities. the Eightfold Path plus right knowledge and right deliverance. Certainly. Certainly, you've got 8 precepts. So many people actually keep 8 precepts on, like, every week, or at least one day a week, on Upaya days, and sometimes they start taking that every day. And so I know some people, lay people, they do that. They just live by 8 precepts. And sometimes that it's harder to do 10 precepts as a lay person, because the 10th precept is basically abandoning all your money, and that's very difficult to do as a layperson in this world. But, you know, you just don't care so much about money. You live very simply. So your simple lifestyle, your renunciation, your restraint improves. And that's how you're training yourself, especially in restraint, restraining your speech. So, you know, you tend, number one, not to talk too much. When you do talk, it's kind. Rather than shouting at people, you can see how the Buddha admonished. You know, he called him a fool, he called him a transgressor, but it wasn't sort of forcefully, it wasn't sort of shouting at him, but just basically saying as it was, with reason and argument. So, you know, you can, if you're in a position of authority, tell somebody off. But you do in a good way. And this is a good example of how the Buddha told somebody off. And so you restrain your speech, and then you restrain your actions, and then you start restraining your thoughts. So it does happen quite naturally. That is the training. For those of you who know it more in detail, you'll know that the precepts come first, and then afterwards comes the sense restraint, which is far more refined than the precepts. And after the sense restraint comes mindfulness. The mindfulness starts to have power when you're not wasting it in unrestrained sense contact. And after the mindfulness comes the jhanas. And after the jhanas comes the insights. That's the gradual path. So that is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Dali was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words, as I hope each one of you were delighted and satisfied with the Blessed One's words. And hopefully each one of you will remember the story, the simile of the colt, that you were paying attention with eager ears, happy to be trained in the dispensation of the Buddha. Any questions before we finish off? Yeah? I hoped you wouldn't ask that. No, it does. It probably does somewhere, but I haven't looked it up. If you want to look it up, in the library, the best books are from Professor Malasekara, who has the Dictionary of Pali Proper Names. It's a great little, huge book, and very, very encyclopedic. So you just look up Badali, and you have, you know, everything written about Badali in the suttas and in the commentaries. And there you'll probably find out what happened to him. Usually, in all cases, he either got enlightened in this life. It doesn't say so here, so he probably didn't get enlightened in this life. So he probably got enlightened in his next life. And they actually say in the commentaries, and later on he became reborn as such and such a monk, and then he became fully enlightened. So that's usually what happens. So, again, please excuse... You got a question? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, you did see things, yeah. Oh, okay, yeah. Obviously, there's some conditioning there, some reason why he was stubborn, which is one of the reasons why it's a waste of time punishing someone. The whole point is, and not to punish him, but to move them forward so that he does become easy to train. And so the Buddha actually obviously left him for 3 months. And obviously one of the reasons was his fellow monks talked him into reflecting on what he was doing. And it may also be the case that for those 3 months he wasn't getting anywhere. So that they realized that perhaps because of what he said to the Buddha. So yeah, in one sense, one way of looking at it, you're not in control. But there is a controlling there. It's not, when I say you're not in control, it's the you part which I'm underlining there. Control happens. In other words, there is such a thing as will. There is choice. You know, you do decide. The point is that where does that decision come from and originate from? We understand it's like cause and effect from outside. And that's why the Buddha can influence. But that's another subject altogether. And if we go into that, I'm going to miss the event this afternoon. So let's now finish off by paying respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho saṅkhaṃ namāmi